This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Hello, good night, and welcome to The Doctor's Inn with Dr. Denotha Archer. That's me. I'm a family physician, family medicine specialist, so I take care of everybody. Welcome to the show where we talk all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society at large. So we have an interesting show for those of you who was with us last week. We talked a lot about, vaccine, also, just the effect of COVID in children. And, we came to the conclusion, I concluded and I agreed with Dr. Ben Carson, there really isn't much of a need for it. There's no reasoning, a really good reasoning behind it. And it's something that we really need to think about as we are moving forward in, as a country, and deciding what we are going to do we go through this so-called pandemic. I say that now because you can see our numbers are going down pretty much really, really good. And so I'm hopeful that there is light at the end of the tunnel and we will get out of all of this. So that is my hope and my dream, that we can go back to the real normal and not any other kind of normal. So tonight, the show is brought to you by Medical Concierge Services for all your healthcare needs, in clinic, out of the clinic, home care, everything that you can think about. Check out us on site, MCS.com. familymedicine.com, and to just see everything that we do there. And we're located 72 Collins Avenue in the Bahamas Heart Center, the Medical Pavilion. And you can reach us at 326-1521 or WhatsApp 429-4880. That's Medical Concierge Services. So tonight we're going to kind of wrap up that whole idea of what's happening with kids. One of the big things, the myocarditis, we're going to touch on that. And then we're going to move into our main topic, which is to do with the health rules that are coming out. And so I don't know if everyone's been paying attention, but we're moving away from emergency orders and we're going towards placing some rules into our laws, our policies that would govern how we as a people would deal with COVID-19. And so it's very interesting to see. And I have a lot of issues with those rules. And so we're going to talk about them. We're going to go through it. We're going to examine what exactly are these rules and whether some of them make sense or maybe they need to go back a little bit to the drawing board. We're going to take a look at those rules tonight. I'm just going to touch a little bit first, though, on myocarditis, just so people have an understanding as we just kind of finish off this whole idea of children and what's happening there. I think it's very, very important to keep hearing it all about. So why are we talking? Why is this conversation of myocarditis really, really coming about? Well, as we go into more and more people being vaccinated, they're looking at the side effects and the issues that some people are having, and people are doing various studies and looking at various things as things start to pop up. So one of the really big things that pops up is this idea of some people getting inflammation of the heart, different parts of the heart, and myocarditis is one of the big ones. So I'll start off with one or two articles that kind of look at this. We'll go in to see what myocarditis is about, and then we're gonna look at those new rules that are coming up. So stay tuned and be here with us. So the first study that I'm going to look at tonight is called Myocarditis After COVID-19 Vaccination in a Large Healthcare Organization. So here we have a report they started looking at it. Basically, reports have suggested an association. This is from the background of the abstract, between the development of myocarditis and the receipt of a messenger RNA vaccines against coronavirus disease 2019. But the frequency and severity of the myocarditis after vaccination have not been extensively explored. So they wanted to look at what exactly was going on, how bad was it, and what was going on. They looked at databases for the Clalit Health Services, which is the largest healthcare organization in Israel, because a lot of data was coming out of Israel. Israel was one of the first countries to really dive into vaccination. A large chunk of their population was vaccinated. And so we were getting a lot of our data. And they looked for whether there were any diagnoses of myocarditis in patients who had received at least one dose of the Pfizer. The diagnosis of myocarditis was adjudicated by cardiologists using the case definition used by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They abstracted the presentation, the clinical course, the outcome for the patients using their electronic medical health record. And they performed a Kaplan-Meier analysis of the incidence of myocarditis after 42 days after the first vaccination dose. So they only went into about 42 days and they looked at who was getting this and how was it happening? So they looked at 2.5 million people who were vaccinated, who were 16 years or older. So this is only 16 years or older because that was the age group at the time. And they saw 54 cases at that time. The estimated incidence per 1,000 was about 2.13 in this particular study. But what they found actually in a particular group, so although it didn't seem like a lot of cases in general, all of those cases were actually in a very small group, which were patients between the ages of 16 to 29. 76% of the cases of myocarditis were described as mild and 22% as intermediate, which is strange because prior to this, you didn't see a lot of mild or intermittent conclusions when it came to myocarditis because it's inflammation of the heart. Usually if you end up in hospital, most people end up in hospital and need some required treatment. So they did kind of split it up into groups. Although I don't know anyone who would want what they're terming a mild case of myocarditis for any inflammation of the heart can be extremely dangerous. One case associated with cardiogenic shock, and after a follow-up of 83 days after the onset, one patient admitted to the hospital, one had died of unknown cause after discharge, and 14 of the patients who had left had ventricular dysfunction on echocardiogram after admission. So these people had permanent changes in their heart, which caused dysfunction of their heart itself. 10 still had such dysfunction at the time of their discharge. And of these patients, 5 underwent subsequent tests that revealed normal heart function. So only 5 people came out with normal heart function out of those persons that they just mentioned. So the conclusion of that study was among the patients in Israel healthcare system who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, the estimated incidence of myocarditis was about 2.13 in 100,000. The highest incidence among male patients, and this is where it comes in because it's the young males, and remember this study was only 16 and above, but they still found that the young male patients between 16 to 29 in that group were the majority of that is of mild or moderate severity. And that's basically what they found. I could go into a bit more, but we'll move on to one of the other studies so that you can just see across the board that a lot of different people have been studying this occurrence. And you hear the words rare, but anytime you have a multiple time fold in an incident of a problem, it is then related to the vaccine per se. So new information for parents on myocarditis and COVID-19. This is coming from Harvard Education. And they just want to talk a little bit about what is it exactly? Because we hear this talk, it's happening, it's mostly affecting young people and more exclusively young males. So what is myocarditis? And we'll also include pericarditis in this as well. So myocarditis is inflammation of the muscle of the heart. It is inflammation of the tissue of the sac that is around the heart. So your heart has a little lining around it that kind of protects it. So myocarditis is the inflammation of the heart muscle itself, and pericarditis is the inflammation of the sac around it. There are usually a lot of different causes for this inflammation. Usually it has to do with infection. So you would have heard that some persons, they would have said if they had COVID really bad, would also have had some form of inflammation of the heart. And so it's usually seen in viruses or some type of bacterial infection or something like that. So surprising, it's really that it's coming up also with vaccination. It can also be caused by autoimmune conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, certain medications, heavy metal poisonings, radiation. So it's pretty nasty disease. You don't really want it. And it can also be caused by vaccine. This is coming from health.harvard.edu, right? And although this is supposed to be rare, but we are seeing it more frequently with this particular group. The symptoms are chest pain, shortness of breath, abnormal breathing, so fast or fluttering or pounding of the heart. Currently, in this particular article, they talked about 1,000 cases of myocarditis and pericarditis that had been reported after vaccination against COVID-19 using the mRNA vaccine Pfizer or Moderna. The cases have been most common in male, adolescent, and young adults, occurring most often after the second dose and usually within several days of receiving the vaccine. The majority of cases have been mild. Experts still gathering information, but about 79% of the teens and young adults who experience it actually recovered. So 21% did not recover, 79% did recover. So those are big odds. Remember, young people, the risk of actually getting COVID and getting any sequelae from COVID or long-term COVID is extremely low. But we can see here that at least 21% of these within this 1,000 cases did not recover. Right, so that's very interesting to know. It's understandable to worry. So of course, you know, they talk about, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. Just kind of think about it before you choose your vaccine or whatever. But we're coming to a point in the world where there doesn't seem to be a lot of choices. So healthy young people are basically able to get this if they choose so. So millions of doses of COVID vaccine have been given, and they're saying that, you know, they only really saw 1,000 cases of inflammation. So cases have to be linked to the vaccine in order to be considered a case and to be counted, all right? And once again, though, however, they're talking about the entire population and not the amount of people within the age group who are actually vaccinated. So those numbers would be more interesting to look at, to see how many within the age group actually the numbers are presenting. Either way you look at it, our young males come out worse than this. They seem to have the higher number of inflammatory cases affecting kids. So they compare and they say, well, you know, maybe, you know, they get an inflammation with if they get COVID. And so is it really, you know, is it better to still vaccinate? Well, most young people, as we talked about last week, don't get COVID unless they are usually have some underlying problem. So when I talk, I like to be in context to know that when you're talking healthy children, COVID is not a major issue. And then they talk about some of that you can get, but that is coming out of there. And despite what the information that's coming out, they're still recommending that we move forward with that. All right, just a little bit more on myocarditis before we move on. We talked about the symptoms, which are chest pain, rapid and abnormal heartbeat, shortness of breath, fluid buildup, swelling in your legs, ankles, fatigue, other signs and symptoms of headache, body ache, joint pain, fever, throat, and diarrhea. Now, when you look at myocarditis in children, and symptoms might also include fever, fainting, breathing difficulties, rapid breathing, chest pain, rapid or abnormal heart rhythms, or what we call arrhythmias. And it's very important that you see your doctor if you're experiencing any of those things. There are lots of complications with myocarditis, including heart failure. You can have a heart attack or a stroke. We talked about rhythms, which can cause damage to your heart muscles and cause you to have other abnormal arrhythmias, and sudden cardiac death. So certain serious arrhythmias can cause your heart to stop beating, and it can be deadly. So that's why I say when they talk about mild or intermediate, you never know what the complications of myocarditis can be. And so to consider it mild when a lot of people have a lot of ongoing treatment and time and have to do testing over a while, it's nothing to really kind of joke about. And so, you know, that's a major thing. So how do we diagnose it? You have to get an ECG. Usually there's a chest X-ray. You can do an MRI. We do an echocardiogram, which is like a scan of your heart. There are various blood tests to check the enzymes within your blood to see if your heart is functioning properly, and biopsy the muscle or do some type of cardiac catheterization. So I don't like the word mild and intermittent when we know that people can have really, really bad times with this and have to do ongoing treatment, usually in hospital and back and forth with out of hospital in order to be treated. And to have any long-term damage to the heart. And so that is a possibility of it. One last article dealing with this, I looked at in News Medical, Life Sciences. I talked about the rate of vaccine-induced heart inflammation in children. And they talked about the chances of death comparatively, and we know that that's low in children. However, the cost of adverse events from vaccine amongst teens and young adults, namely myocarditis again coming up. They also mentioned the study in Israel and also the studies that were done in the U.S. And so in August 2020, the Federal Drug Administration identified potentially a 1 in 5,000 risk of myocarditis developing in teen males. So when we look specifically at males, we can see that a teenage male is a lot more likely to actually come out with it. So when we take that out of the big pool and we look specifically at males, it's down to 1 in 5,000. So what does that mean? If 5,000 were to be vaccinated, one of them probably may get myocarditis. That is what they're saying, the risk of myocarditis developing in a teenage male. The CDC also reported an approximately 95% hospitalization rate for the myocarditis-related adverse vaccine events. Persons that got myocarditis ended up in hospital. They looked at what we call a preprint study. So before things are widely spread to the community, research and papers and scientific stuff go through various processes. And one of them is being in a preprint stage where it's waiting to be kind of peer reviewed. So you have all the data, you've done all the work, it's there, it's kind of being waiting to be, you know, kind of looked at by everyone in the community. But this is where a lot of information comes out about this particular subject, because it's so fast paced and so much stuff is happening. So a recent paper uploaded in MedRxiv looked at a risk benefit analysis was undertaken, they suggested that alternative vaccination schedule may be most appropriate. They kind of concluded that either you change the way that you give them the vaccine or you reconsider how it's given, but they found an issue with, because of all the reports that were happening in the VAERS system. And so, you know, today, none of these reports want to specifically say, you know, don't do this or don't do that. But everyone could see that there is an issue within that population. Okay, so they look further at the number per million of people, but I don't like the number per million. I like to look specifically at the kids. So that 1 in 5,000, I think, really hits the nail on the head. It said that the group found that 15% of adverse events occurred following the first dose and with the majority after the second dose. So most adverse events occurred 2 days after vaccination, with 91.5% occurring within 5 days. So it seems like after the second dose is where we were seeing that a lot. And this was, I found very, very, very important to compare the rates of vaccine-induced adverse events to the rate of hospitalization that could have been avoided by vaccination. The group obtained COVID-19 hospitalization records for individuals in the same age group, also considering comorbidities that were found to increase the probability of hospitalization by 4.7-fold, with 70% of hospitalized children bearing at least one. As around 20% of children are obese in the United States and almost 10% of asthma, in addition to the wide range of other related conditions any child may bear, such as diabetes, the group estimated that 33% of children in the 12 to 17 year age group suffer from at least one COVID-19 morbidity, but they found some time fold with in terms of vaccine induced adverse events there. So they went on to look at the healthy adolescents, their risks due to hospitalizations, and teens least one comorbidity at the rate spikes at about 210 per million and 294 per million in periods of intense or acute respiratory syndrome of coronavirus. Just basically the rest of this article just talks about how likely kids would be to be hospitalized due to coronavirus versus vaccine-induced injuries. That's the age group of 12 to 15. They also talk about the 2 to 1 times more in the age group of 16 to 17 year olds. But places where rates were extremely low, we see even more that it's all right. So the article ends, and this is newsmedical.net, that long-term health effects of the mRNA vaccine on teenage boys is unknown. Few clinical trials have been conducted due to the early observation of adverse events. The group suggests that vaccination of this age group could be done on a case-by-case basis, allowing the risks and benefits to be weighed for each individual. Countries such as Germany and Norway have avoided recommending vaccinating children altogether, whilst the UK is considering distributing just one dose of the vaccine to these individuals. The vast majority of serious adverse events occur after the second dose. So that article concluded pretty much that they thought there was more risk there versus not, and that either you need to adjust the schedule or maybe like some of the European countries, not for children. So that's definitely something for us to consider whilst we're considering moving forward with all of this. And I think it's very important that we note that. So what are we gonna really talk about tonight? We're gonna talk about it. We're gonna take a quick break and we're gonna come back and we're gonna look at the health safety rules that are coming out, which are gonna be practically law, I think is gonna be the law. So I think it's important that we kind of look at that and what does that mean? And whether these laws are really, you know, what with the direction that we need to go. And so we're gonna take a look at that after the break. We're gonna take a quick break right now with the doctors and with me, Dr. D. Archer. I'll be back in a moment. We're gonna take a... Producer, are you there? Let's take a break.
Life is always better with a little extra cash. At Solomon's, we know that every penny saved is a penny toward more happy times with those you love. With super savings in every aisle and budget-pleasing buys every time you shop, you can get closer to that family vacation you've been dreaming about. Go on, earn that new air fryer in produce. Snag that Exuma getaway with your cereal. Ross and Square Junkanoo tickets, aisles all together at Solomon's, where you can save more and live better.
Always on the the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to The Doctors and with me, Dr. Dinothra Archer Carter. Thank you for joining me this Tuesday night for listening in for all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. We like to talk about the topics we know that are going to interest you and are very pertinent to what's going on in today into society. We were talking about myocarditis and how it's affecting young men who are vaccinated, as well as children who do get really bad COVID. And so it's a really important subject that we need to look at as we're looking at vaccinating younger and younger people. But we also want to talk tonight about the new health service COVID-19 prevention and management of community spread rules of 2021. So these are supposed to replace the emergency orders that have been in place since this entire pandemic started. And so we want to put some things in law so that they can kind of govern what's going on. But are we moving towards mandates in a sense without calling it a mandate? These laws are going to be basically enacted and we're going to be required to follow them. But I think there was a bit of a miss with these particular rules. I think this is definitely, and I don't want to say this, but it seems almost like they just cut and paste this from someplace else. Because I don't think it's relevant to what's happening in the country. I don't think it's relevant to what's going on right now with us. And I think it's kind of like 10 steps backwards in a sense. And so I'm hoping that our leaders will take another look at this and kind of maybe realize that this is not the way to go. If you're watching what's happening around the world, there's a lot of division going on, vaccinated people, vaccine passports, vaccine mandates. People have been protesting all around the world because of the intrusive and authoritarian way that healthcare is being used to govern and control people. And, we've been kind of silently getting there in the Bahamas. And I think we've been passively taking a lot of stuff, because in the United States, a lot of part of the United States, you can't force someone to wear a mask. You can't force a lot of things, even though they've been changing their rules and regulations, but they're fighting against virtual things. A lot of things we've accepted as Bahamians, most of us really want to make sure that nobody gets sick and nobody dies. And so we've kind of been passive with this. But at some point, do we really need to focus on what's really going on? So we're going to go through, we're going to talk about what these rules imply and what they are and how they're going to affect us. And, if you want to join in, you can join in. I pretty much have an open, I'm not gonna stop you if you wanna join in at any point. So our number is 322-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. But it's important that we all understand what's happening and realize that this is going not to just be an emergency policy, but laws. So, it starts off, the minister in exercise of the powers conferred by Section 29 of the Health Services Act, Chapter 231, makes the following rules. The rules may be cited as the Health Service COVID-19 Prevention and Management of Community Spread Rules of 2021. The rules shall come into operation the 13th day of November 2021. I don't know if they've actually pass these, but if they have, we all have a bit of a problem. The application of the rules, this is part two. These rules shall apply to all the islands of the Bahamas and other less unless otherwise specified, and shall be read and construed in conjunction with the Health Services COVID-19 General Rules 2021. Part three, the declaration of COVID-19 pandemic. Are we still in our pandemic? That is a question. And what is the definition for a pandemic? And so I think here we need to clarify what is a pandemic within our country, and we do not here. For the purposes of Section 29.2A.9 of the Act, it is hereby declared that there exists in the Bahamas a pandemic of COVID-19. So they just kind of declared that. They go into part four, goes into some interpretations in the rules, what is an accredited lab, the COVID-19 protocols, which means protocols provided by Rule 7, 8, 9 of the Health Services Act. Rules, they call it, they're not calling it an act, they're calling it rules. I don't know what that means if it's going into law. They talk about what is it to say is a COVID-19 test, what it is to be fully vaccinated. So this is very, very important. So the COVID-19 test, they talk about it just being means for any molecular test method utilizing nucleic acid amplification, right? Anything, I guess, antigen tests recommended by the WHO, whatever it may be. Because we all know that the tests that we've been using, they're going to soon say that one is obsolete and move on to something else, which is another story in itself. But what do they describe a fully vaccinated person as? So for those people who are vaccinated, you should pay attention to this particular aspect because this is what they're saying here. It says fully vaccinated person means that 2 weeks have elapsed since the person has received the required doses of a vaccine. So that's very important. Required doses of a vaccine. There's no number there. So that required dose can change. So that can mean any number that is, so if it's 10 doses, if it's 12 doses, that changes with, oh, sorry, the audio is in and out. That changes with, I hope that's a lot better. That changes with, and let me just turn up, okay. That changes with whatever is done. So if you're fully vaccinated, you feel, okay, I'm totally in the clear. That is not very specific. It speaks to the received, the required doses of a vaccine authorized by the World Health Organization or by the stringent regulatory authority as defined by the Caribbean Public Health Agency, which has received an emergency use license for emergency use drugs. There is basically what it's saying. If you've been, if you've gotten the required dose, so that's for all the persons who are vaccinated to realize that the required dose may not be when you consider fully vaccinated, and that can change. So they also talk about isolation, what it is to have mandatory isolation. So there is parts of this that speaks to mandatory isolation and being able to put people in mandatory isolation. It describes the medical officer of health, who's a medical practitioner, the minister, what it means to be quarantined, and quarantine means the separation from others or persons who have been exposed to COVID-19 for a period of at least 14 days. All right, and mandatory isolation means the separation from others of a person who has tested positive for COVID-19. And so as you can see, quarantine, they can quarantine you for, you can be quarantined for 14 days if you're even in contact. And then of course, isolation if you're positive. It speaks to residential care establishments and also social gatherings. So you'll see that comes into play later in this rules where they talk about social gatherings. And that's one of the main issues that I'm gonna have here. So social gathering means a gathering of persons present together in the same place in order to engage in social interaction and includes a wedding not held in a church, a wedding reception or a repast. So any kind of event happening. They talk about what the surveillance unit is and what it means to be symptomatic. So it means that a person is exhibiting symptoms of COVID or may be suffering from COVID-19. Part two of the rules speak to the domestic and international travel. So the first part, part five, talks to international travel. And it speaks to what are the requirements for entry for citizens, for legal residents and for visitors. And so except as otherwise provided in part, and there's a dash, I don't know if this was the uncompleted version, but a citizen or legal resident of the Bahamas who is present, who presents a travel health visa, or a visitor who presents a travel health visa, complies with all legal requirements for entry pursuant to the provisions of the Immigration Act, shall be permitted into enter the Bahamas. So this right here puts the travel visa, embeds it into the law, which I don't see why we need to do that at all, right? In fact, I found the travel visa very cumbersome for you with that. And my experience when I was coming home, we realized very late that my baby, who is less than a year old, who's only about 7 months at the time, required a health visa, even though he did not require a test. And we literally were at the airport at the last minute, you know, for about an hour or so, just hoping that someone would respond to us. We ended up having to call the people in charge of the health visa, explaining to them that, you know, this kid doesn't have a test, because when we tried to do it online, they were asking for a test, and they had to go down and explain, and they had to go and find their boss and explain to them that the child doesn't require a test and all this stuff. So it was very, very stressful situation for Bahamian turning back home. It was harder to get back into New Providence than it was to go to the United States. It was crazy. And so that health visa thing, I'm not really for it. I'm not really for it at all when it comes to Bahamians. I don't understand if when I'm going to United States, if I present just an antigen test, I could have gotten into the U.S. You know, the rules have kind of changed a little bit now, but and it's amazing, as things get better, the rules get stricter. But I could have presented an antigen test, get into the U.S., but coming back home, PCR tests, all kinds of stuff. It was intense and it was very scary, because at one point we thought we weren't going to get our tests back in time. And then we had to call the place in the United States, and they were like, oh, it's not done. And it was on someone's desk, and they had a hard copy, and they didn't send it to us. So that health visa thing is very, very stressful. Definitely there are better ways to do that. And that version of it, but don't like it. Okay, so part 6 talks about the requirements for the issue of a travel health visa. And this is where we get our first little taste of discrimination here. So for applicants for travel health visa who are fully vaccinated, so they've differentiated between the vaccinated and the fully vaccinated in terms of criteria. Now, we've been traveling all this time, and it's been pretty much fair. Even under the emergency health orders, we've all been pretty much the same. I think it was only for a short bit last year that they actually slackened the rules for the vaccinated, and we saw the surge in cases. Undeniably, we saw an increase when there was no testing being done for the vaccinated persons. And we've come to realize vaccinated, unvaccinated, anyone can carry COVID. Viral loads are the same. So there's no reason to go in this path of really separating people. Huge difference between the two. I ask the question to people all the time, does it matter who you get COVID from? If you get COVID from a vaccinated or an unvaccinated person, does it change the situation? I don't think so. And so I don't think with all the information we have out there that we need to make this distinction, but here it is. They've separated it. I don't know if this is legal. Anybody in the law would have to tell me if you can discriminate in this manner, but they separate the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. So if you're fully vaccinated against COVID-19, you have to submit via the travel health visa portal documented evidence that you're fully vaccinated against COVID-19. And you have to undergo a COVID-19 test administered by an accredited lab no more than 5 days before travel to commence. Submit or cause to be submitted to the ministry via travel health website results of the test, together with contact information and all of that. So you have to do a test. It doesn't specify which COVID test. It seems like you can do any one. It's fine if you're vaccinated. If you're not fully vaccinated, they want you to do a RT-PCR. And so there's no doubt about about that. You have to do an RT-PCR. And so I don't know why there needs to be a distinction. If you, if both categories of people can carry COVID and spread COVID, then the testing should be the same. So if you are allowing any test, let's say an antigen test, then it should be for both. And I think at this point, an antigen test, right? Is a child between the ages of 5 and 11, they shall undergo a COVID-19 test administered by an accredited lab in more than 5 days. So children 5 to children are very unlikely to be spreaders of COVID or have COVID. They still need to be tested. So that's, you know, there's a lot in that process. And then of course the guardian has to do that. There's no mention of the children under that age. So I'm not sure exactly what that means, if they are being taken off of having to do a travel visa or not. Right? And then we'll go into later on, we talk about the fees, because there's also a bit of discrimination there. You still, if you're unvaccinated, you have to pay these fees, even if you're Bahamian. So a travel health visa is issued. This is part two of that section. To a person referred to in this rule shall be valid for travel into the Bahamas for a period of validity of the COVID-19 test being taken to obtain the travel health visa in accordance with Rule 10. The holder of the travel visa shall not be required to undergo a further COVID-19 test to embark upon inter-island travel where the test submitted to obtain the travel health visa is still valid. So it's within your family, you can travel through the other islands using the exact same test. Now the cruise ship passengers all have to be vaccinated basically. There is no room for anything else. And I think the cruise ships are requiring vaccination for those persons. While cruising in the Bahamas, we're subject to the testing requirements mandated by the cruise line operator as approved by the minister. Every cruise line operator should comply with local and international guidance document governing health in the cruise line industry as approved by the minister. So they sound like they're going a lot with whatever the cruise line is doing, and then the minister just approves of that. Now, failure to comply with conditions of entry. So if they find out that you didn't comply with any of this, you can be detained at an appropriate place designated by the minister. So in a lot of our laws, we give our ministers a lot of power. So the minister can basically say that you can be detained. And you can be screened in accordance with Rule 20. And so that's any citizen or legal resident. So even if you're a Bahamian and you don't comply to these rules, if you've entered without doing any of these things, the minister can ask you to be detained. And you can be given the screening that is required. A visitor who enters the Bahamas and fails to comply with these rules commits an offense and shall be, and so this is an offense for both citizens and visitors. And so visitors who enter can also be detained by the minister. They can be screened and liable to deportation to the last port of embarkment at early opportunity. Where a visitor is detained at a private place, the cost associated with his detention shall be at his own expense. So pretty serious stuff here. Bahamians can be detained, foreigners can be detained, and it's basically an offense. When we talk about Section 9, which is our inter-island travel, that's Part 1, 9 Part 1, a person who travels inter-island as a passenger in any aircraft or vessel from an island listed in the second schedule shall, at the point of embarkation, produce to the operator of the aircraft or vessel. So once again, we see a separation of persons. If you are fully vaccinated inter-island travel, the negative results of a rapid antigen test or an RT-PCR. So I'm wondering sometimes if they missed out or if this is how it's supposed to be written, because we see with the other travel that they just say a COVID test. And then here they're very specific that can be a rapid antigen or an RT-PCR. Usually when you're looking at legislation or acts, they usually want to have some conformity. But this seems to be written kind of like all over the place. So I'm not sure, and I'm assuming and I'm hoping that if you're not fully vaccinated, you have to do an RT-PCR. So I don't know why, if you can do a rapid antigen test for one person, why you can't do it for the other person. But they're specifically asking for an RT-PCR, which, if my memory serves me correctly, is going out of commission a lot of these tests by the end of December. So we're putting into laws, and I'm not sure if we're going to be using RT-PCR in that particular way after December. And proof of this exemption, right, so that's a person's not fully vaccinated. And I don't know how they say not fully vaccinated. Everything on this banks on vaccination, as if vaccination is the default, when the default is actually unvaccinated, and because you actually have to, you know, go and get injected and have medication placed inside of you to be vaccinated. So if he's not fully vaccinated, I'm not sure what that means, and they didn't describe what that means either. But because that is an odd statement, and it makes it seem like there isn't actually a place for the unvaccinated who are citizens of this country and global citizens of that. Proof of his exemption from the requirement to undergo a COVID-19 test. So they speak about that exemption, but I don't remember seeing further in here where they talk about any exemptions of going to do that test other than some emergency stuff. A person who travels inter-island from an island on the second schedule and is the operator of a private aircraft or vessel which he is traveling shall produce a negative result of COVID-19 test to the officer in command. Once again, it's very loose language, COVID-19 test. I'm not sure if that's how it's supposed to read. Shall, when asked to do so, produce a negative result of his COVID-19 test to an officer of the Royal Bahamas. So if you're traveling from the second schedule, or you're operating an aircraft, if you're the person that's driving the aircraft, I guess, they're saying that you have to have a test. They're not very specific on what this test is. Part three of that section talks about persons referred to in this rule who does not comply with the COVID-19 protocols specified by the health services. Okay, so this part I really didn't understand. A person referred to in this rule who does not comply with the rules, paragraph 1 and 2, a request made pursuant to paragraph 2B. So I'm not sure if they were supposed to be talking about exempted persons, but they're just saying that those persons commits an offense and is liable upon summary conviction to a fine not exceeding $1,000. So they can charge you up to $1,000 if you don't go by these rules. So these aren't really rules, these are laws or mandates. A person who travels inter-island from island not listed in second schedule should not be required to undergo COVID-19 test. So if you're going inter-island, or those things on the second schedule, which is strange because those things would change. And it's interesting to have laws when you know that things are going to change so rapidly here. Where the minister makes a person who travels inter-island from any island not scheduled in the second schedule should not be required to undergo COVID-19 testing. Where the minister makes an order restricting travel to or from any island. And so this really is just emergency orders placed not in the hands of the prime minister per se, but just in the hands of the health minister. So I don't know how this becomes any better than what we've had, and creed and not very flexible. So at this point, I'm even starting to think, hey, maybe the emergency orders would be better than this, right? It goes on to talk about the validity of the COVID-19 test in section 10 and about the different diagnostic places that can be done. So a holder, part two of that talks about a holder of a travel health visa whose journey to the Bahamas extends beyond the period of validity of a COVID-19 test shall be permitted to enter the Bahamas, provided that the captain of the vessel can prove at the point of entry that, hey, the aircraft or the vessel to Bahamas commenced prior to the expiration, the travel to the Bahamas was direct with no prior stops to any other calls. So if you happen to land in the Bahamas and your test is, because your test is if your test is like expired just as you enter, then that is basically, they will exempt you from that. And then they do talk about some exemptions here from requirements to undergo a COVID test. And the test for re-entry is within 24 hours of departure. So when a person travels from the Bahamas and returns within a period of 24 hours, the person should not be required to undergo a new COVID-19 test to re-enter. When a person travels from an island listed in the second schedule to any island in the Bahamas and returns to the originating island within a period of 24 hours, the person shall not be required to undergo a COVID-19 test. And so those are kind of like the exemptions for entry there. Exemption for emergency travel from the second schedule is also mentioned, and they talk about written confirmation from a medical officer, minister, the commissioner of police, and this is for any kind of emergencies. Part B of that emergency scheduling has to do with employees of an aircraft, a person who is doing any kind of freight or passenger emergency services, and they won't have to do a COVID-19 test, but they have to get permission. Exemptions for specific categories of persons. They also discuss that, and then they talk about mandatory post-entry COVID-19 testing. And so we're going to talk about the mandatory requirements for secondary testing and some of the other screening parts. Then we get to the really interesting parts about, having events and people coming to your house. I guess that's the prevention and management and community spread aspect. So we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk about it. And if you have any questions or concerns or comments, call in. We're listening to you and we want to hear what you think so far about the break. And we'll be right back on The Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. D. Archer.
Is always better with a little extra cash. At Solomon's, we know that every penny saved is a penny toward more happy times with those you love. With super savings in every aisle and budget-pleasing buys every time you shop, you can get closer to that family vacation you've been dreaming about. Go on, earn that new air fryer in produce. Snag that Exuma getaway with your cereal. Rawson Square Junkanoo tickets, aisle 7 just restocked. Bring it all together at Solomon's, where you can save more and live better.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
We're back on The Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. Janotha Archer. We're on Guardian Radio 96.9. Thank you for joining us for all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. Tonight we're talking and we're going through the health services, COVID-19 prevention and management of COVID community spread rules for 2021. These are the rules that are being proposed to replace the emergency orders that are in place and give us something to be governed by. Now, these are, I guess, going to be laws, rules that we are all supposed to follow. So I think it's important we all take a look. I think we kind of on the wrong track with some of this stuff. And I think we're almost really, really past that. So if you want to join in the conversation, 322-6232-325-4316, 325-4259. So that's 322-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. So we are on part, it starts to get kind of a little more interesting here. So it talks about the prevention and management of community spread and your obligation to report. So this is something a little bit different than we've seen even in the emergency orders. I'm not sure if we actually covered obligation to report. We didn't talk about it as much, even though it might have been embedded in there. So part 16 of this talks about the duty of the head of household to report an outbreak of COVID-19. So it says where a resident of any household is symptomatic and that person is referred to as the patient, the head of the household to which such patient belongs or his nearest relative or other responsible adult in the house or a person in charge of or in attendance on that patient shall, as soon as he becomes aware or suspects that the patient is suffering from COVID-19, forthwith inform a medical practitioner that the patient is suffering or suspected to be suffering from COVID-19 and call him in to visit, call a medical practitioner to see the patient. So they're putting responsibility on the head of the household to know who in the house has COVID and to actually inform a medical practitioner of that. It goes on in part two of that to speak to where a medical practitioner attends on comes and attends on a patient, he shall notify the surveillance unit that the patient is suffering from COVID-19 and provide information. So that part is pretty basic. A medical practitioner, the head of the household that he belongs to or whoever is in charge basically becomes aware of the suspect is suffering from it, should notify the surveillance unit. So they're saying that the person in the house should actually call surveillance and tell them about it. In the event of a death of that person, the medical practitioner basically would be in charge of that situation. And those who were not attended by a medical practitioner at the time of death, the head of the household would be in charge of informing a medical officer of health about the death of the patient. The duty of operator, part 17 of the residential care establishment, talks mostly to residential places where, you know, if they become aware, some of the similar things that it just that in a residential place like a group home where older people might be, it has a similar rules in effect. About number 18, quarantine of a person suspected of COVID-19. And it talks about quarantine being like 14 days, beginning from the time which the person's quarantine under the rules begins. So once they kind of find out that 14 days from there, once they develop the infection and they're required to do screening, I guess part 19 is the imposition of screening and other restrictions and requirements where a person has been quarantined according to section 18, a medical officer can orally or in writing impose one or more screening requirements, carry out an assessment based on the outcome. They can also impose continuation of the quarantine. They can release a person from quarantine or they can transfer a person from quarantine. So the medical officer gets quite a bit of power there as well. But this in keeping with some of the stuff that we already are doing. Restrictions or required imposed under paragraph shall be made with the medical officer considers the restriction of requirements appropriate. So I just think that in some of those places, it may just need to be a little bit more specific so that there is no one that abuses that power. Part three of that section talks about restriction or requirement under imposed if it has to do with a child, ensuring that there's compliance or restriction requirements and provide any written notification of restrictions or requirements imposed very as soon as reasonably practicable. So it just talks about how you're going to then deal with it if the person is mentally challenged, if it's a child, and making sure those requirements are met. Requirements that you have to be truthful and answer questions, anything that the health officer can ask you, you have to be truthful. This part I have to query. So for the purpose of these rules, a person required to undergo screening shall answer questions in a truthful manner about his health or other relevant circumstances, including travel, health, symptoms, contact information about other individuals with whom he may have had contact. Produce any documents which may assist a medical officer in assessing his health and allow a medical officer or his designate to take from the person a biological sample. So someone is calling me online. Don't call me on my phone. You can only call me. You can call me on the Guardian numbers, which is 322-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Do not call my number because I will not be able to take the call. So you want to call the Guardian line. I can take your questions there, but I cannot take your call on my private line. So I find that is quite interesting there because once again, don't call me on my private line. I am not available to take calls there, and you will have to call me through the Guardian radio. So whoever's calling me, I hope you're hearing that. Do not call my private phone number. And that number, I don't know that number, so I'm not sure who that is calling me. All right, so we are talking about the health and safety rules that are proposed. And once again, don't call me on my private line. Please call me on the Guardian line. I cannot take your call right now. For the purpose of these rules, so we talked about that, you know, you have to answer all these questions. Any document they ask you to produce, you'll have to produce. Allowing a medical officer or designated to take from the person a biological sample, including his respiratory secretions, appropriate means, including but not limited to swabbing of his nasal pharyngeal cavity. I think it gets a little intrusive here. I'm not sure about why they're putting it in there in that particular way, but these are things that I feel like should require a person to say yes or no, blood or saliva. So I would need clarification on that. Provide a sufficient contact information to enable immediate contact tracing. That is quite understandable. Taking the samples, not too sure to expect someone to provide a sample if they don't want to. If you, I guess that is to confirm a diagnosis, but I think that one can be a little bit tricky. All right, part two of that, where it's a person or a child or someone who's mentally, intellectually incapacitated, is some of the same things that they'll be able to do. Part 21 talks about mandatory isolation of persons who test positive with COVID-19. Saying that a medical officer of health should require a person to keep in isolation in accordance with the rules. And if that person has tested positive or has been reported by a medical officer to be suffering from COVID-19, he considers it necessary and proportionate to do so in order to remove the risk of that person from infecting others. I really am a big believer of letting people I know it's an infectious thing and you would want to know, so I think most people care about each other, and if you are infected, you would go along with isolation. My problem is putting them into law, and we all know that laws can be abused, so I'm not sure how I feel about this particular aspect. I think when it was the emergency orders, we knew it would all end. When you put things into law, it sounds like it's a very long-term thing. Where a medical officer of health determines that a person shall be kept in isolation, he shall notify that person, or where the person or a child is mentally ill, and notify a responsible adult. So some of the same stuff there. And a lot of this stuff is, if in the opinion of a medical officer of health, such a house or part of a house can be used an effectual place for isolation, persons such that the house shall be deemed an isolation station. So quite a few things left up to the medical officer. I guess that's fine. That gives a bit of flexibility. I just hope there's no abuse in some of this stuff. And part four of that talks about the medical officer's health determines that a person should be kept in isolation under this rule. He may impose or in relation to that person, restrictions or requirements, including ongoing screening requirements and tracing of contacts. The medical officer of health shall give to a person who is required to be kept in isolation an isolation card that outlines the circumstances of isolation, including the place of isolation. So it sounds like they can tell you where to be isolated, the length of time you will be isolated, any restrictions or requirements that the person must adhere to. and the isolation card shall be signed by that person and a copy retained by the medical health officer. So as you can see, these are even a little bit more restrictive than even under the emergency order. So very kind of tight control there. I'm just hoping there's no abuse in that manner. So I don't like how that reads. Monitoring a person in quarantine or isolation. A person placed in quarantine and isolation should be monitored by persons authorized for tracing contact, blah, blah, blah. That's okay. Medical officer of health as a condition to be monitoring under paragraph require a person placed in quarantine or isolation to provide information. So more of that kind of stuff. Offenses in respect to violations of quarantine. Basically, if they put you in quarantine and you abscond or you try to leave quarantine or isolation, if you intentionally or recklessly provide false information, if you fail to comply with any of the orders, it's basically an offense. You're liable upon summary conviction to a fine not exceeding $1,000 or a term of imprisonment not exceeding 2 years, or to both such fine and imprisonment. So breaking these quarantine or isolations, you can go to jail and you can pay a fine. How people feel about that, if it's heavy-handed, or if they think that's what needs to be done. But yes, they are saying that you can be fined or you can go to jail by breaking those rules. And then it goes, number 24, it talks about them giving you a letter and releasing you basically from isolation. I don't know if you've had any cases of people actually running away from isolation or going places they shouldn't have, but I would have to look at the statistics on that to kind of make a good determination if these rules are heavy-handed or if they are, you know, people are doing it and that's what they need to do. This is where it gets a bit tricky as well. We see a bit more of that discriminatory kind of discussion here. Business operations, so 25, business operations. Subject to the provisions in this subpart, this rule shall apply to all businesses. A business may operate provided that business prepares a protocol document containing guidelines relevant to the business, completes the ministry's workplace assessment online survey, I'm not sure about that, and ensures that every employee is familiar with the content of the approved protocol document. If it's going to be something like that, perhaps the ministry can actually provide what an outline of the protocol would be and people just sign on to it. So this whole idea of everyone being very, very specific, I think there should be some guidance with that. And that's something that can be easily fixed. And the ministry may review or cause review of any business to determine compliance with its protocol document, these rules and health services. So the ministry will now have the power to kind of come in and review your business and determine if you're following the rules. A business which fits a first offense, $5,000, up to $5,000. A second offense, up to $10,000. And on a third, a further offense, a suspension of its business license for a period not exceeding 3 months. So hopefully this is not the final document, because it sounds like a lot of money for struggling businesses. So you would really need to have all of your protocols in place. The minister, on the advice of the chief medical officer, ordered the closure of any business due to an outbreak, spread, or reoccurrence of COVID-19 or non-compliance. The determination to close any business pursuant to paragraph 5 shall be contingent on the full evaluation and assessment of the surveillance unit. In terms of residential care establishment, it talks there about what would the hours of visiting be, which is like interesting. They want you to limit out sure why or what that has to do with anything and how that would decrease the spread of COVID. Sounds a lot like some of the emergency arbitrary laws of just adding times and dates to things. Ensure that a person entering or remaining in an establishment should adhere to the COVID-19 protocols. It's fine. Have at least one isolation area. I don't even know if that's possible within some of the public arenas. Ensure that all employees are fully vaccinated or submit to a COVID-19 testing every 3 days. So this is also quite interesting here, this document, because it does state about being fully vaccinated and submitting to COVID-19 tests. adhere to any guidelines issued by the approved ministry. As I read this more and more, I'm wondering if this is just a draft, because that in itself is just would have to go. Educational instruction, it speaks to persons entering and remaining on campus, shall adhere to protocols, is fine, having an isolation area. Okay, we have a caller. Caller, you're on the line.
Yes, good morning, Dr. Archer.
Hello, good night.
good night. I was working from 8 o'clock this morning until just now. So, you know, the thing is, I really appreciate this information. I appreciate you. I mean, it's like, I'm all alone. It's sad, Dr. D. It's really sad. We're moving towards a technocratic dystopian panopticon, right? Based on pseudoscience, right? You know, I like pseudoscience because without pseudoscience, establish real science. Science doesn't start off with just, science starts off with something. You see what I'm saying? It just didn't start from any, you know what I mean? It's an established methodology. And so, I was just listening to all of the narratives over the past week. And one of the things that drew attention to me was the fact that you heard him talking about the faulty rapid antigen test, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so that caused me to draw to the conclusion that we really should have already had a gas chromatography machine, or they call gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. You understand what I'm saying? Because with the knowledge I have, that means they don't even know what's coming in. They're just going with what people are telling them, and they're being fed these narratives. And I saw, Dr. D, you have to keep me on the track. There's so much things to discuss.
I'm angry.
It's mind-boggling. You say the tests are faulty, but you didn't check them to see the ingredients in them. So everybody's a guinea pig because of the lack of consciousness. And so, there's a psychology to obedience, which is a catalyst to totalitarianism, and despotism. And this, it feeds that. And so I listen to you and I appreciate this because, I understand everything what you're saying. Common sense, when you talk, discuss pericarditis, myocarditis, myo means muscle. You know, peri means around, so that obviously I put together, and then itis would be an inflammation. So even if I didn't know the word, just through the general knowledge that I have, I'm able to put together these jargons, right? But they hate me. They hate me for speaking the truth. Somebody said 52 hasn't made a contribution. He always called Tom a COVID-19. But I'm sorry if my knowledge befuddled their big little brain, right? But just to say things like that, it's not factual. So I was hoping to see. They say I make no contribution. I don't make contributions. I make distributions. I distribute consciousness. You see now, Dr. D. Another thing to concern is, some facts, right? The VAERS report, right? The VAERS reporting system, right? It's controlled by the CDC.
VAERS.
Yeah. Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, whatever. It's controlled by the CDC, which is a conflict of interest, and we know that. And so when you look at statistics and how they manipulate relative and absolute risk reduction, the word absolute obviously means more accurate than relative, because it could be relative to 500 people, relative to this, relative to that. So when pharmaceutical companies are allowed to dispense drugs based on relative risk reduction, like Pfizer, this is what they did. It says on their paper, relative risk reduction. But, just forget that. Yeah, another thing is, I try to get...
Well, if people want... What I try to tell you, 52, is you just have to talk the knowledge of an absolute reduction. Most people don't know what you're saying, but people can understand when you say that the way that they calculated the efficacy and their rate of reduction was not in keeping with what we call the gold standard of science and studies. But
Dr. D,
it seems to be a very low threshold for large pharmaceutical companies that are kind of bankrolling everything. But if you were to counter that with other information, they want the gold standard and information to refute what they're doing. There's a lot of stuff coming out about...
Dr. D, I don't know. I know you're married, but I'd just like to communicate with you from my mind because, the thing is about absolute risk reduction. Absolute, Dr. John Campbell, in some of his peer review studies, I see where he's using absolute risk reduction. And then in the background, I would see relative risk reduction. But relative risk reduction is only for clinical trials. It's not for when you're dispensing drugs to the public. And so it's just so many things to cover. And I don't know if you were familiar with, or you saw the Supreme Court put a freeze on Biden mandatory vaccine.
Of course,
they're not talking about that.
But here we are in the Bahamas slipping in all of these things in the guidance of safety and protection. But when you're saying, you know, these people need to be vaccinated and the vaccinated get to do this.
Yeah, but I like how you explain the science. You know, I'm not cutting you off, but there's not much time left. But I appreciate Dr. Darvill, right? But he says he knows the science. But I want Dr. Darvill to know, right? You know, I respect him a lot. He's knowledgeable.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one knows the science. That's why they keep studying. I don't even know the science. That's why I keep studying. You know, there's a study came out the other day, which we noticed because Dr. Sheehan Crawley and some other doctors, that's who Fauci them has used. But it shows where the obese, this is really a disease of the obese, where the obese people, this has shown the decrease
in
the
vitamin D. We know all of this, but we still keep on deluding ourselves with other stuff.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the lack of vitamin D, which leads to a higher inflammatory response. But it shows that obese people are not producing antibodies. They're producing autoantibodies, which you know what that means. You know, I don't need to get into all of it. But what I'm saying is, Dr. D, also Inform Action Network, right? Inform Consent Action Network. They highlighted a case the other day where the Health and Human Services failed to disclose to Congress for 30 years a safety data vaccine report update, right, to Congress, you know, to the NIH and Health and Human Services. And these are things on the books. They're from 1988. These people haven't disclosed a vaccine update and safety report. You understand what I'm saying? And then another question.
You got 30 seconds. I got to just get through the last bit of this thing.
But another question is, how long does the body continue to make spike protein, seeing that there are studies coming out now showing that the spike protein is entering the nucleus of cells and causing DNA disruption in repairs, et cetera, et cetera. All right? And it's also, that's what I'm saying, Dr. D, where's the real science, man? You know,
they're still finding
Yes, what I want you to do, please. Mm-hmm. I would like for you to really discuss herd immunity, because a lot of people, you know, a lot of people really think that herd immunity means transmission will stop. This is they're being deceived. You understand what I'm saying? Please, man.
I think I talked about it before, maybe not completely, but I think I mentioned before, because the concept of, you know, vaccination and herd immunity is no longer.
Another question is, Dr. Bertrand Russell
knows that this particular vaccine cannot provide herd immunity because it doesn't stop transmission.
But we know that, Dr. D, I'm a fool and I don't know what I'm talking about.
The only herd immunity that we can get at this point or hope for is if we get that through natural immunity, which most people aren't even acknowledging.
Dr. Bertrand Russell, who is a polymath who lived in the early 1900s, a philosopher, et cetera, he wrote a book, The Effects of Science on Society, right? And so I get to realize from then, I knew about scientific dictatorship from like the late 80s, right? And now I'm living and seeing it, and people still can't see what's about to happen, Dr. D. I don't even want to be amongst these people, man. I just got to get Cat Island. I don't even want to be amongst
the ignoramuses. You got to relax because...
Yeah, the Bible says so, you know, but...
The problem is it's cognitive conditioning. You know, I talk about...
Operant conditioning, yeah, I mean, you know, I understand
being
educated. But you're very educated. I always learn it from you.
Yeah. People are being conditioned that when they hear the science, which is a misnomer or almost pseudo-science.
They hear anything on the news, they believe it.
You know,
if they put
the
a picture of me and say, kill 50 people, they believe that, they run with that. Just like when they say they raped a little girl.
Science has become a person or a thing, which is not true. Science is always changing, evolving.
Yeah, the structure of science, Dr. Khan. You know, I take a break, man. Hey, Dr. D, you're my brethren, right? I read in the Bible straight to you, man. I have an elderly friend who's much older than me. She's very knowledgeable, and she's always guiding me. She's listening. I mean, it's just, man, listen, man, I appreciate them so much. Bless up. I appreciate you, Dr. D. Bless up.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're going to get through the last of it. We might be able to take one more caller if they're interested. But this just last part, let's just go through, just finishing off the new health safety rules. Some of it is a bit intrusive. I'm hoping that the powers that be, if they're listening, they're going to revamp this before they make this into any kind of law or rules. So 29, if you look at the restaurants and how they can operate, when they talk about inside dining, again, we continue with the discrimination between the vaccinated, where all the patrons have to be fully vaccinated and they have to have a negative or rapid antigen test. Well, the vaccinated people are probably saying, well, why do we have to have a test? Well, it's because you can still catch and pass on COVID. So what makes you different from the unvaccinated? I have no idea. But they're allowing you to eat indoors, but they also require you to have a test because you need to have a test if you're gonna, if that's the way you're thinking about COVID. So this whole idea of providing the vaccinated with, I guess, with their it's like you're gifting them something, but it's just the rights that they always had. I don't understand that because we all had these rights. We gave up some of our rights for our health and safety, and now they're being gifted back to us if we do particular things. So the fully vaccinated can dine inside, but they have to have a test, an antigen test right now in order to do so. And that should be for everyone. If you're gonna have testing, then it should be open to everyone, but I don't see where they actually allow that for the unvaccinated persons. So they say all needed or have a valid negative rapid test, antigen test. Okay, maybe that's an or, so I have to pull that back. Or have a valid negative rapid test. Okay, that's kind of doable. So that means that the fully vaccinated then don't have to be tested. My bad, let me just recorrect that. I'm not sure what if that means that if everyone is fully vaccinated, then it's no test, or you have a fully vaccinated test. So I just need clarification. So that's on my bad. I kind of read that wrong. But I don't know why we're instilling these things into laws when, you know, people are falling away from all of this. Like I said, just been to Florida. You don't have to do a test to get in there. You don't have to be vaccinated. You can eat indoors. You can do lots of different things. And I think it's very restrictive. So those of you, and I've been in the restaurant business, you know, so these are still very restrictive laws. And are we moving forward or backwards? Are we going to live with COVID, these things in place? So I know some people are very kind of frightened and they want all this testing and stuff. But I think at this point, if you're frightened, and you should stay away from these avenues. Maximum seating being 50% of seating capacity in the restaurant, with a minimum of 30 square feet per person. So that really depends on your size. And I think that's gonna be better for larger restaurants rather than smaller restaurants. And I don't know how well restaurants are doing on 50% occupancy. That means that they can't hire back all of their staff and they're gonna have to cut some costs somewhere. Seating is arranged in accordance with physical distancing and protocols. Also very difficult if you have a very small place. Masks are worn by staff in accordance with the protocols, okay? Masks are worn by patrons when dining at all times, except when eating and drinking. This rule is the weirdest rule that I've ever seen because you're at events and people have on their mask and then they take it off to eat and then they take it off to drink. And then all of a sudden, you know, they put it back on. So these things have to make some logical sense. I think this means people can come in, then people can come in. I don't see the difference between sitting to a table and putting your mask on when you're not eating and drinking and then putting your mask off and then eating and drinking. At this point, we are beyond that. I think we need to make sense. Tables and chairs and other implements used by patrons are sanitized after each use. Neither here nor there. Somebody asked me a few weeks back why, you know, we used to see all this, you know, heavy cleaning and stuff and we don't see it anymore. Because the science has shown that a lot of that stuff doesn't matter. If it's passed by respiratory droplets, then usually viruses and other things die fairly quickly on surfaces. So yes, you can do your sanitizing cleaning, but that big cleaning after everything, they didn't find to be very effective. A restaurant should be permitted to operate utilizing outside dining, provided that the COVID-19 protocols are adhered to, staff and patrons, table, chairs implemented. Okay, that's fine. We're doing that now. Subject to, so 30 talks about public transportation, taxis, private cars, all of that stuff. And it just is subject to guidelines issued by the ministry. So that obviously is not going to be into the rules. And so I think too, like we need to do some of that stuff is like, you know, outside of this. Religious instruction and social gatherings. That's interesting again. So a church or place of religious instruction or worship may conduct services, including weddings and funerals, in accordance with the protocols established by the Bahamas Christian Council and approved by the ministry. So So the Christian Council obviously got their say in there, active in becoming a part of this plan. Funeral services conducted in a church or a place of religious instruction shall be conducted without the presence of the remains in an urn or casket inside the church. Okay, I don't quite get that one. But anyway, a church or place of religious instruction or worship on an island listed in second schedule may conduct services provided that the attendance is limited to 33% of occupancy. All right, so 33% of occupancy and protocols established by the Bahamas Christian Council and the ministry. Graveside, they just say COVID-19 protocols and any protocols issued by the Bahamas Christian Council. So the Bahamas Christian Council have actually gotten in there and have been able to, I guess, get whatever they needed in there. So they're going to dictate their own rules. Social gatherings. A person may host or attend a social gathering at a private residence with not more than 20 persons or at a facility provided that all vaccinated and all COVID-19 protocols are adhered to. So once again, discrimination. I think this one is the biggest. I don't know why. If you can test to go for dinner, why, if you're having a private gathering or a social event, they didn't mention it here. A person may host or attend a social gathering held outside, provided that all attendees are fully vaccinated or present a negative COVID-19 test. So they give you that option for outside gatherings, but still they somehow give the fully vaccinated a pass on testing. And we all know there have been events with fully vaccinated persons in the U.S. where people have caught COVID, subject to adherence to all COVID-19 protocols. A person who hosts or attends a social gathering contrary to this rule commits an offense and is liable upon summary conviction. Interesting. In the case of a host, you can be fined up to $2,300. I don't know how they wrote it like this. So they might need to go over this just a little bit. And in case of an attendee, a fine not to exceed $300. So you can be fined being in attendance of a place or being the person that hosted. And so this is what they want to put into law. Recreation and competitive sports. And I heard that there was a lot of problems with this because it says, this is part 34. And I'll just say this quickly because we're actually out of time. You're going to have to go over some of this next week. But a group of recreational competitive sporting activity may be held provided that persons engage in activity of the participation. So participants, coaches, persons officiating all need to be fully vaccinated, all have to have the persons watching, so everybody involved in this, they're basically saying needs to be vaccinated. And people had an uproar because you're talking about young people, students, everything. And really, it goes into professional sporting as well. And so we're going to have to take up the rest of that next week because we're basically out of time. So we're going to finish that up next week. And if you have any questions or calls, we'll get into it right then. But thank you for listening tonight with the doctors and with me, Dr. Janotra Archer, brought to you by Medical Concierge Services. You can catch us on Facebook and Instagram or our website, mcsfamilymedicine.com. Good night and see you next week.